welcoming Miss Carl Maggie?
Colin McGee,
sorry. Who comes from the University College London, and she's going to talk about the emergence of differential provision for migrant residents in a Belfast urban regeneration project. The floor is yours.
Maybe on now? Yeah, great. So thank you so much for having me here today. I'm really delighted to be here in this beautiful building and hearing these wonderful talks. So yes, the title of my presentation is The Emergence of Differential Provision for Migrant Residents in an Urban Regeneration Project. And you can see a little image on the slide of the neighbourhood where that project was taking place, or at least part of it. This is based on ethnographic fieldwork I conducted in a small area of Belfast where I was also living throughout 2022, although my most recent observation took place just on Tuesday because I'm struggling to let go. And I'll show you a map of that area now, so you can see it in small, kind of where it is within Belfast, southwest. And you can see then the area in a bit more detail. The area is home to about 6,500 people, and it comprises two neighbourhoods known as Sandy Row and The Village, locally. These were grouped together under the 2003 Strategy for People in Place as the Southwest Belfast Neighbourhood Renewal Area. Bit of a mouthful. The neighbourhood was selected due to being identified via a combined deprivation measure as being among the 10% most deprived urban wards in Northern Ireland. My fieldwork was based at the four organisations, which I call Centres A, B and C, and the Women's Centre, which were tasked under the 2003 strategy with conducting urban regeneration in this neighbourhood along the connected themes of economic, social, community and physical regeneration. Under these categories, the expansive remit of these organisations extends to housing, crime and policing, emergency food provision, physical regeneration, public art and beautification projects, educational and youth projects, health and fitness, English classes, skills training and job seeking, just to name a few. This set of ambitions for the strategy forged during what McCabe called the double transition towards peace and neoliberalism following the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland signal towards urban regeneration as operating not only on the physical spaces themselves, but the sort of responsibilised post-conflict citizens who will inhabit them. So I wanted to take this as an opportunity to consider how and why certain events, organisations and services connected with regeneration have differentially interacted with migrant residents. How certain aspects of the regeneration project have been discursively constructed as being of particular relevance to their needs. How migrants' use of such services has been construed by the organisations and some of the consequences of these differences. In particular, I'll look at the emergence of the Women's Centre as the only regeneration organisation to offer specific services directed towards migrant residents and to include them in longer-term planning and programming activities. This centre has made provision for migrant residents a core part of its mission, despite this not being one of the original goals of the 2003 strategy. And it has thus become the de facto migrant centre for the area. I want to explore how and why that's occurred and offer some examples of ways the Women's Centre has attempted to move beyond only offering ESOL and to make migrant women part of its advocacy work. I'll suggest that at the other centres, migrants are understood as transient and incidental users who do not feature in their long-term plans. Thus, while migrants are eligible for certain types of one-off assistance, including, for example, advice about hate crime incidents and navigating government services, they do not go on to form part of the life of the community centres. As a consequence, these residents are not involved in forward plans for the area. Programming and budgets for these services are not designed with their needs in mind. They're not brought into ongoing support, and they're unlikely to benefit from the same kind of advocacy that the centres offer to people with whom they have ongoing relationships. And I'll suggest that if we understand urban regeneration projects as involved with producing certain types of citizen, what might explain the difference between the Women's Centre and the other three community centres is their conception of who can be a citizen in the neighbourhood and what that type of citizen should look like. Before I go any further, I want to just give a note to how I see this contributing to the theme of the workshop. So, taking my cue from the three lines of linguistic work on economic issues, which provided by Professors Mufwene and Vigourou in their 2017 book on this subject, I see this as an instance of the type of scholarship which is work inscribed within the general theory of political economy, investigating the crucial role played by language in fostering socioeconomic and political inequalities at both the macro level of nations and the micro level of groups and individuals, so sitting around that area of scholarship. And in this case, I want to connect the very concrete work of regeneration with the communicative practices through which this regeneration work is being done, including translating, negotiating, mediating, assessing, advocacy, all taking place in interconnection with a web of other governmental and social bodies and actors to determine how the resources associated with regeneration should be directed and used, with material consequences for all residents of the neighbourhood. So I'll go on now. I think I've been quite wordy. And just say a word about the context in which this urban regeneration project is happening. So the context of a deeply divided society renders the concept of community and urban regeneration more problematic in Northern Ireland than in many other places. That's from Muir, 2013. The conflict in Northern Ireland, known as the Troubles, which took place from 1969 to 1998, was profoundly shaped by space and reshaped the space of the region in turn. More than a third of deaths took place in just five postal districts, and fear of violence led to entrenched residential segregation, such that by 2001, more than half of the Northern Ireland population lived in areas that were 90% or more single community. So people are living in ethnic enclaves. And what you can see on screen is actually a distribution of deaths during the Troubles, with also, which I'm afraid are too small to see, multiple deprivation measure numbers associated with those areas, and if you could see them, you would see that the areas where the deprivation is rather high, the deaths are also more intensely located. The control of particular neighbourhoods became the source of political strength for paramilitary organisations during the Troubles, with the symbolic identification and political control of such places becoming crucial to the reproduction of the identities of Irish republicanism and Ulster loyalism. That's from Gallagher and Sherlow. So this is an image of the neighbourhood I've been working in. These are just two pictures of some streets. There's a lot more I could show you. In just this way, the neighbourhood where I conducted my research, which is known as the Village in Sandy Row, have been claimed as loyalist and as a place where the loyalist identity is reproduced. Loyalism is a contested term, but broadly it's associated with Northern Ireland's Protestant ethno-national group in support of continued union with Britain in opposition to republicanism and associated with the Protestant working class. Indeed, loyalist imagery erected by paramilitary organisations and by community groups continues to dominate the semiotic landscape of this area. And these are just a few examples. However, in the post-conflict era, Northern Ireland has emerged as what McAreevy, 2017, calls a new destination for migration. While this framing risks masking the existing presence of residents, especially from Chinese backgrounds in this area, and see Jack Crangle's work for more on that, it is certainly the case that the pace of inward migration to the area has increased in recent years. New residents have been drawn by the proximity of the area to local universities and hospitals, as well as the patterns of housing availability in the neighbourhood. As a result, between 2001 and 2011, this area experienced the largest change in community background across all neighbourhood renewal areas, and is now home to people from many different nationalities. The backgrounds of these people tend to be quite diffuse. It hasn't taken on a particular, it hasn't become home to a particular national group, but there have been notable arrivals of people who arrived in the 2000s following the accession of the A8 and A2 states to the EU, and people who have come from the Middle East and Horn of Africa in more recent years. In the academic year 2019 to 2020, there were 210 children with English as an additional language in schools in the area, which is quite substantial given the small number of residents in the area, and it is now host to Indian, Middle Eastern and Chinese convenience stores, takeaways and cafes, and Turkish barbershops. And you can actually see two Middle Eastern shops in that, sorry, I'm pointing at my own screen, in that slide. Pardon? Oh, sorry, yes. Oh, can I? No, I'm sorry, I'm not capable of this. But you can see that the shops behind there are actually Middle Eastern shops, but an orange march is preparing to set off from right in front of them, which I think is a nice juxtaposition. So The homogenous presentation of the neighbourhood by those who feel entitled to erect public displays of national and paramilitary ownership in the form of flags and murals not only disguises the migration that has taken place here, but also acts as a disciplinary measure to remind new residents whose turf they're on. Indeed, the relationship between traditional residents and newcomers has been fraught. The village was the site of several notorious issues and incidents of violence targeting Roma and Eastern European people in the late 2000s in connection with ongoing paramilitary activity in the area. And it continues to have a reputation as an area of heightened racism, a reputation people working in the community centres were aware of and wanted to resist, often preemptively bringing this up as an example of unfair negative attention on loyalist communities. That being said, there were 28 recorded crimes with a racist motivation in the area in 2019, that's in 1 year, and the PSNI estimates that is underreported. Thank you. And some of the richest data currently available about migrants in the Sandy Rowan village area exists in reporting related to hate crimes. There is a direct relationship between territory marking, the understanding of the neighbourhood as being traditionally loyalist and sectarian hate crime, which is designed to preserve the resources of the neighbourhood and in particular housing for the traditional community of the neighbourhood. So that's a comment about the social housing. I won't actually linger on that. So the neighbourhood organisations operate in and play an active role in shaping this context. They can do this in several ways, through their position as mediators between government bodies and local people, for example, by holding official consultations on planned physical regeneration projects, through their ability to make authoritative interventions in local discourse, for example, by making statements or holding public meetings to respond to events. One of these actually happened just yesterday because a local leisure centre is planning to put up Irish language signage and one of the community centres is trying to encourage residents to resist this. Through their power to distribute or influence the distribution of certain resources, and in the case of the community confidence role, which is hosted at Centre B, with their direct role in resolving conflicts between residents. I'll say more about that later. As such, their stance towards an engagement with migrants in the area has the potential to be consequential not only in the immediate results of particular interactions, but in shaping the discursive environment in which residents relate to each other. Actually, not just yet. However, as I mentioned earlier, it quickly became apparent to me that the approach taken by the Women's Centre was distinct to that of Centres A, B, and C. These latter three centres have similar histories in that they were set up towards the end of the Troubles with the aim of promoting development on a single community basis. And in the cases of Centres A and C, they had a particular mandate to help loyalist ex-combatants reintegrate into the community after leaving prison. Centres A and C have previously employed such ex-combatants as members of staff. And indeed, actually, one of them is now the chairman of Centre C. All three of these centres display a strong British identity, which is reflected in the physical decorations set up in the centres, which typically reflect the symbolic environment of the streets outside the centre, with union flags and royal memorabilia. These are also reflected in the type of events promoted by the centres and in the affiliations of staff members, some of whom have ties to political parties such as UKIP and the DUP. This is not to say that every member of staff has stridently loyalist political views, but the ambient environment of the centres reflects a homogenous understanding of the local community that they serve. This homogenous understanding is reflected also in how staff at the centres speak about migrants, particularly emphasising that they are transient, live in private rental accommodation rather than, as most traditional residents, in either social housing or owner-occupied houses, and that they need instruction in integration and understanding the local way of life, often illustrated with narratives of migrants acting in strikingly inappropriate ways. But even when migrants are not mentioned, they often speak in general terms about the characteristics of people in the area in a way that does not reflect diversity within the population. For example, that the population is elderly or diminishing in size. The Women's Centre, which is pictured here at the outside of it, had a slightly different early trajectory in that it grew out of the women's movement of the 1990s, which aimed to produce cross-community links between women's groups in different parts of Belfast and across the island of Ireland. While it was established and continues to be run by local women, Its relationship with elements of the local community, particularly local paramilitary groups, has been fraught. Colette, the finance manager at the Women's Centre, who has been there for 22 years, told me that shortly before she began working there, the centre was firebombed in protest at the fact they had invited Irish President Mary Robinson to give a speech at the centre. She told me, that's why some of the artwork in the main building's a bit singed, because it was kept up as a memory of what had happened. Colette described how during consultations on plans for a new park in the area, some groups objected to the new space because they thought it would belong to the Women's Centre, and they don't like the Women's Centre. And they don't like that the Women's Centre has this building, has that bit of land or anything, that we exist. Indeed, I have encountered some negative opinions about the Women's Centre in my wider research, including during an unexpected conversation with a local paramilitary, during which he offered the opinion that they don't work with you, they don't work with the community. Colette's assessment of the reason for the dislike was different, because we're a women's centre, and, well, I think that arouses suspicion in people as to what's going on there. I also think it's to do with the fact that we have an open-door policy and there's all religions, ethnicities, cultures welcomed here, that we don't colour-code people when they come in the door. Indeed, the Women's Centre is distinct among the renewal organisations for having a substantial migrant user base, which it actively fosters. Divya, who runs the education programmes at the centre, was originally hired in the year 2000 for a year-long project to assess how it could meet the needs of women who had recently arrived in the area for overseas, primarily as the wives of men who were working in the hospitals. She then became a permanent staff member, coordinating first ESOL classes and then a wider range of accredited courses, including numeracy, IT, childcare qualifications, alternative therapies, and others, as the demand and ability to provide them arises. Divya emphasised the need to avoid migrant women falling into silos within the centre. She wanted them to get into ESOL, but she wanted them to get out of ESOL and into the other groups and activities. While she felt this was a work in progress, migrant women are present across many of the courses, craft groups and social events at the centre and have become involved in groups including, for example, Maternal Advocacy and Support, MAS, which is a group which offers peer support for maternal mental health while also campaigning for a mother and baby mental health unit to be introduced in Northern Ireland. In the context where this is occurring, it is easy to lose critical distance due to the sheer novelty of seeing migrant residents being taken into account by this organisation. However, I do want to say that the Women's Centre is not exempt from some of the logics which we have talked about regarding the integration of migrants, the reasons behind doing English classes, the familiar phenomena which involve, while expressed in compassionate language, the construction of these women as lacking in skills and the motivation to acquire them, and the channeling of these women into particular forms of work. Divya shared with me her sense that she meets women at pivotal moments in their lives, perhaps when they have just moved to a new country or during the years when their children are young, during which time they neglect themselves in favour of their families, with the result that after this period they are isolated and find it hard to gain employment. She could become frustrated when women at the centre failed to grasp this urgency. I had the opportunity to observe a three-day workshop she had arranged, during which women from migrant backgrounds were offered training in the theory of play work, followed by interview skills and a mock interview, at which point interviews were arranged for them at childcare centres where vacancies were available. Following the workshops each day, Divya and the external trainer would compare notes on the attitudes and suitability of the attendees for various roles, and Divya complained about the attitude of one woman in particular, who she had helped extensively over the years, but who had failed to turn up to the course after the first day. But for many women who know that participating in English and skills classes may be the only route to manage in Belfast, the Women's Centre offers a desirable option. It is local, it offers childcare while they study, and it offers the opportunity for social connection, which is not available at these other centres. Having looked at the particular case of the women's centres, I now want to turn to centres A, B and C. How am I doing for time? Okay. Thank you. And outline the ways in which migrants were included in the work of these centres. So, I was meant to have a slide here, but I don't. But that migrants tended to interact with these other three regeneration organisations in three main ways. This was either through being referred by other agencies, such as the Job Centre or police, to particular services, which would include the Community Safety Unit or the Advice Unit. So this is when they are referred in for a particular incident which has occurred. They also were involved through being invited to specific diversity initiatives, which were posed either as learning opportunities or as celebrations. They were also involved through attending open public events, such as Christmas or July celebrations, or the open community fridge that was set up at Centre B. Taking each of these in turn, I will start with referrals. The responsibility for community safety lies with Centre B and is designed to minimise police involvement in disputes between neighbours, especially given that the police and local paramilitaries have had a fraught relationship in the past. The service also verifies whether paramilitary and community-issued threats are legitimate and provide local support for people who have been the victims of crimes. Given the tensions between migrants and traditional residents in the area, the community safety officer, a role which had been held in the past by a woman named Susie, would often be called upon to mediate when disputes arose between neighbours from migrant and local backgrounds. Susie, along with many other staff members at these centres, had stressed to me the dangers of people interpreting simple interpersonal disputes as expressions of racism. She shared a number of stories which presented her attempting to verify incidents of racist harassment and finding that they had been exaggerated or fabricated, emphasising to me how some migrants cynically claim that they are being intimidated so that they can claim maximum housing executive points, allowing them to move to a more desired house or neighbourhood. By her estimation, the communicative practices involved in listening to and assessing such incidents have the potential to be highly consequential, given that these housing moves may be at stake, although in this case it wasn't clear whether Susie's accounts had in fact influenced any immediate decisions. In the interests of time, I will skip over the advice unit for now, but it's a similar type of service where people are referred in by perhaps from the job centre because they are having issues claiming the benefits that they need, and there are particular trained members of staff who will help them deal with that particular issue, and then they will leave the centre again. Again, this is based on bounded interactions which do not extend beyond the completion of the task at hand. The second way in which migrants tend to be involved at these centres is when specific events are being held on the theme of diversity. For example, Centre B hosted a Small Worlds Cafe event to allow children from local schools to hear the stories of migrants who had come from outside the area for the day. Centre C has also hosted encounter events for local people to meet Polish migrants. Christine, the centre manager, told me, "For a period of time, we had a lot from the Polish community, and they were coming here to work, and there was a lot of issues, just cultural differences. So we began a number of programs here where we had local people and we had people from the Polish community take part in looking at our similarities and differences from different cultures. And it breaks down that barrier, and that's not really an issue anymore." Centre C has subsequently invited a local Asian women's group to hold a Diwali celebration and has held a diversity day at a vacant space nearby with foods from different cultures, dancers, drummers and inflatables, following a similar set of activities which those who have looked at these type of celebrations will find quite familiar, I think. In these cases, the purpose of the engagement is evidently to serve an educational or entertainment purpose for the usual centre users. Such initiatives are often organised as one-off activities in the schedule of the ongoing support groups attended by local people, who continue to reproduce racist discourses when alone with other local loyalists. And I mention this because I was at a community consultation this Monday about the establishment of a good relations hub at a nearby site, where several women who I know to have participated in some of these activities expressed strident anti-migrant viewpoints, with one woman going so far as to say, "I never used to be racist, but I am now." Finally, migrants often interact with these centres when open events are held. Centre staff have described how migrant residents have brought their children to community fun days held around Christmas and the 12th of July, which is an important day in the Protestant Northern Irish calendar. However, I have repeatedly heard negative evaluations of the behaviour of migrant residents at such events, where they are perceived as looking for freebies, taking more than their fair share and taking without contributing, refusing to put in a fiver when the doors are knocked for donations, for example. Similarly, when a community fridge opened at Centre B last June, people from migrant backgrounds began visiting the centre to obtain food. However, centre staff quickly became outraged at the perceived overuse of the fridge by migrant women and put up new signs warning people to limit how much food they took. As you can see from this image, the point of the community fridge is that it is not a food bank, it is rather an initiative to reduce food waste, and this is food that is near its sell-by date and would otherwise have been thrown out. At the consultation event on Monday, one staff member at this centre recounted how she had needed to intervene. "We had trouble with foreign nationals coming in, but we've overcome it to say, no, you can't take that, which has taken a lot of courage from us. But we had to put boundaries in place and be that well, I'm not a community leader, but to be that representative of what the community feels. With this, I've partly wanted to demonstrate the very unvarnished racism that continues to surprise me every time I visit these centres. But more importantly, I want to illustrate how centres A, B, and C, at centres A, B, and C, the engagement with migrant residents tends to be on one-off bounded occasions and fails to produce a sense of ongoing community between residents of different backgrounds. Yet this sort of ongoing engagement is where people become involved in planning for the centres, the design of programmes and consultations about the future of the neighbourhood, and where they develop the sort of relationships with staff that enable them to access help more readily. Susie from Centre B told me about a steering group she runs composed of local people who attend the centre, who feed into decisions about what projects they run and how they implement them. She stressed that everything they do grows out of a need that people have expressed. If I was going to write a book about best practice, she said, it would be about getting out and connecting with people and finding out what they need. She described how she is constantly grabbing people in, finding one point of engagement with the centre and using that to help people access services that will benefit them. By contrast, migrant residents seem to be allowed to conclude their business and go. At the Women's Centre, Colette echoed this sentiment. I would meet with participants for all the different classes and find out what sort of things people feel they want or feel we could provide for them, and then I apply for funding in order to get that going. It could be just as a catalyst for something, and then it develops into something completely different. All of that is generated by people themselves. Employing discourses of empowerment, she continues, we don't really do anything for anybody other than be here, you know? You have to do it yourself. While this sense of empowering the community is the same, through providing them with a space to express their voice and desire for what they think should happen in the neighbourhood, while that sense of empowering the community is the same, importantly, it is only at the Women's Centre that this community is seen as including migrants to the area. I have attempted to articulate the common thread between the type of activities which invite engagement by migrants at centres A, B, and C, namely that hold migrants at arm's length from the deeper community engagement work occurring elsewhere in the centres. I also wanted to try here to integrate my understanding of the work of the Women's Centre with that of the Urban Regeneration Project as a whole. All of these centres appear to be attempting to pursue their mandate of transforming the physical and social space of the neighbourhood in line with the wider normalising project in post-conflict Northern Ireland. To do so, all of the centres attempt to work on the people they see as eligible to become citizens of this new space. And one of the most important ways they see of doing so is to bring people into the ongoing fora in which they become part of planning and imagining how life in the neighbourhood should be. However, it is only the Women's Centre which sees the migrant population of the area as potential citizens rather than as transient presences who are relevant to their work only as they relate to traditional residents. While the approach taken to the Women's Centre offers advantages that simple exclusion does not, I also just want to reflect on the fact that it is also part of the project of constructing these economically resilient entrepreneurial citizens who can still be responsibilized for their own failure to become employed or more generally succeed in Northern Ireland. So they're not exempt from what we've discussed today. It is possible that these different but connected approaches may be partly explained by the orientations of the different centres towards the Good Friday Agreement settlement, where the Women's Centre may be seen as more historically aligned with its political agenda, while the other three centres may be understood to have resisted this project in some ways by insisting on continuing to operate within a single identity framework and conceiving of protecting resources for their own community as an important function of their work. I think that's where I'll leave it. Okay. Whew. It gets warm when you start talking.
Thank you so much. Is there any question from the audience? Both on site and online? I know it's been a long afternoon.
Graveyard shift.
Me? Manuela?
Yeah. Thank you very much. Of course, I'm interested in the Women's Centre because it is connected to the 1990s movement. I was wondering, because it's a long span of periods, I mean, is there an evolution between the beginning and the end? And you spoke about the openness and the lack of ethnicity and barriers concerning this kind of issues. It was the same at the beginning. Do you have any ideas? Sorry.
It's hard for me to say definitively because there's only one person who's still there who was there at the very beginning, and I haven't managed to pin her down yet. But I will say that, so, I mean, absolutely the Women's Centre has seen a big evolution. I think in the 1990s it saw its primary objective as being involved in that kind of peace building, women subverting this idea of community division and taking the steps that men were not willing to do. And I think that was what they saw as their main project. However, at the time, the women's movement, there was actually a lot of really interesting anti-racist work happening in Northern Ireland in the 1990s, which kind of got diverted in a sense. Not stopped, but it turned into a different form following the Good Friday Agreement, when I think a lot of exciting movements with a lot of energy maybe had some of that energy kind of captured by now focusing on the settlement that had been achieved. So it's certainly not inconceivable to me that they may have had some, you know, interesting stuff going on there, but I simply don't know. However, I do think it's notable that, you know, before even this strategy for people in place was set up, and this was the official strategy, it had no recognition of the presence of migrants in the area whatsoever. Even before that, the Women's Centre were actively looking for ways to, they were noticing that there were women in their community from other backgrounds who needed particular services and attempting to set those up. So I think it's quite early. So that's one thing I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you please go over the idea that migrants are considered as transient? I don't think I got the full sentence, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think with the way that the local community, the traditional community imagines itself, this idea is rooted in people who have been through the troubles, people who have had generations of their family, you know, born and die in the same kind of council houses that they have occupied, they've gone through the industrial period and the post-industrial period. They feel they have a sort of a shared history with important moments and important moments of kind of banding together during the period of violence and things like that. I think that the idea of migrants as transient partly comes from the sense that they can never share that type of history, which is essential to being seen as part of the community, I think, by a lot of people. So, you know, even if you've been there for 10 years, you're sort of a blow-in, you know. But I think it's also to do with housing tenure, and I think that's really important, because basically this area really did not have privately rented houses until quite recently. And I think that the presence of migrants in landlord-owned accommodation where, you know, they can be evicted easily, you know, they may not even be leaving of their own volition. And I think, you know, maybe just the fact that migrants, you know, may choose, perhaps, you know, maybe they have had some unfortunate incidents with local people and they've decided they are going to leave. I think that the area maybe doesn't feel optional to people who see themselves as, rooted there. But I do think that housing tenure is an important part of it. And I did actually have something more to say about that, but I cut it out because I thought I wouldn't have time. But I think that's an important part.
So that seems to have to do with the degree of attachment.
Yes, absolutely.
To the neighborhood.
Yes.
Not necessarily that they come and go.
Absolutely.
But they are not equally invested in the tradition.
Precisely. And I think, you know, what kind of shows that is the fact that the Women's Centre actually does have long-term relationships with a lot of migrants who live in the area.
Okay.
I mean, you know, so in fact, it's not that migrants are always leave immediately, you know. Some do, of course, but some have continued to be part of the centre for, you know, many years.
Okay. And then there's another thing that caught my attention, the impression that Ireland is actually in transition from, or Belfast, in transition from ethnic enclave to an integrated population structure. Mm-hmm. Is this the case, or is it a misinterpretation on my part?
I think that's precisely what the strategy for people in place is designed to try and achieve, and other similar regeneration strategies. The problem is seen as being that there are these ethnic enclaves. The solution, whatever the various solutions that are being proposed, are trying to achieve this society where people can all be free to, you know, interact with each other on a kind of an equal level, and all public space is neutral space. And, you know, but in practice, this has not been achieved by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other comments?
No. Okay. So, do you have a comment? Just 22 seconds. No, I'm just kidding. Can you talk on the mic so people online can hear you? Thank you, Alfonso.
Yeah. So I imagine, Koila, you, or maybe you do have an answer to this, but I was just curious to hear what your thoughts about that are. So how do you explain the fact that while the Women's Center clearly has another strategy, another way of dealing, they seem to fall back, you said it a couple of times, they seem to fall back in a kind of routine or mode, I don't know how to call it, ideology, mode of thinking, which mirrors what is done in other places. How would you explain that?
I mean, I think that a lot of the way that the Women's Center, so the Women's Center, for example, it's covered in a lot of slogans like, you know, believe in yourself, you know, allowed to dream, we learn to fly, this sort of thing. I think that while the Women's Center was actually very radical for where it was, particularly when it came about in the 90s, I don't think it's immune to kind of discourses of, you know, sort of self-empowerment, you know, self-improvement, you know, women kind of overcoming their own mental barriers to achieve more than they thought they could. I don't think that those things... And I also, you know, I think, I hope it's clear that I have quite a lot of affection for some of the, you know, I think that the Women's Center is, you know, it's a really interesting place, and I really think they're trying very hard, and they do some things that are just not being done elsewhere, but I can't, you know, fail to notice that these things are still present there, you know. Yeah, I'm not sure why they can't escape, but none of us can, I suppose.
So, No other question online? No, there is no one. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to all the speakers. That was a very fruitful conversation with different aspects of the intersection of language, economy, and migration. So we'll see each other tomorrow. For those who are online, just wanted to stress that there is another link. You should have another link to connect to the other site where we are going to hold the conference, which is the University of Chicago Center in Paris. And we hope you'll be there with us online tomorrow. Thank you to everyone. Thanks.